Judges chapter 4. When Ehud was dead, the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who dwelt in Harosheth Hagoyim. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, for Jabin had 900 chariots of iron, and for 20 years he had harshly oppressed the children of Israel. Now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at the time. And she would sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the mountains of Ephraim. And the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. Then she sent and called for Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kadesh in Naphtali, and said to him, "Has not the Lord God of Israel commanded, go and deploy troops at Mount Tabor? Take with you 10,000 men of the sons of Naphtali and of the sons of Zebulun. And against you I will deploy Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his multitude at the river Kishon, and I will deliver him into your hand." And Barak said to her, "If you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go." So she said, "I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, there will be no glory for you in the journey you are talking. For the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman." Then Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kadesh. And Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali to Kadesh. He went up with 10,000 men under his command, and Deborah went up with him. Now Heber the Kenite of the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, had separated himself from the Canaanites and pitched his tent near the terebinth tree, Azaia-Naim, which is beside Kadesh. And they reported to Sisera that Barak, the son of Abinadab, had gone up to Mount Tabor. So Sisera gathered together all his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, and all the people who were with him, from Harosheth Hagoyim to the river Kishon. Then Deborah said to Barak, "Up, for this is the day in which the Lord has delivered Sisera into your hand. Has not the Lord gone out before you?" So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. And the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. But Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Harosheth Hagoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not a man was left. However, Sisera had fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. For there was peace between Jabin, king of Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite. And Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me, do not fear." And when he had turned aside with her into the tent, she covered him with a blanket. Then he said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty." So she opened a jug of milk, gave him a drink, and covered him. And he said to her, "Stand at the door of the tent, and if any man comes and inquires of you, and says, 'Is there any man here?' you shall say, 'No.'" Then Jael, Heber's wife, took a tent peg, and took a hammer in her hand, and went softly to him, and drove the peg into his temple, and it went down into the ground, for he was fast asleep and weary, so he died. And then, as Barak pursued Sisera, Jael came out to meet him and said to him, "Come, I will show you the man whom you seek." And when he went into her tent, there lay Sisera, dead with a peg in his temple. So on that day, God subdued Jabin, king of Canaan, in the presence of the children of Israel. And the hand of the children of Israel grew stronger and stronger against Jabin, king of Canaan, until they had destroyed Jabin, king of Canaan.
Thanks, Dave, for reading that. Appreciate your participation. So, Judges chapter 4, story about the first half, is a story of Deborah and Barak. By the way, they also continue on in chapter 5, which we'll be discussing today. That'll be in hopefully 2 weeks from now, which I'll have a reread chapter 4 again to get context for chapter 5 when we discuss chapter 5. I couldn't combine them all into one because it was going to be really long. So, any questions or comments? Something that caught your eye in Judges chapter 4, the story of Deborah and Barak.
I think Richard. Five names.
Names?
Hagoim.
Yes.
The Goim.
Yes.
And then his first name was Harosh, the head of the Hagoim. That was funny.
Yes.
Oh, what a word. It's like a word. I thought it was cool.
It is. Yes, David.
I wonder if that's where the expression "I've got you pegged" come from.
Yeah, I figured. She warned about that. Yes.
Name is
so,
actually,
say that again.
Well.
Oh. Yael. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Is the name not Jael, but
right.
Yael, which is Yahweh El. Her name is actually Yahweh God.
Yes. Yeah. Yael, or God is Yahweh is God. Yes.
And you had the word Yahdi right there. I'm interested from the enemy.
Oh right.
Yeah. An
interesting name. Yeah.
It's an interesting name there.
They do have quite a few different names.
Kadesh?
Yes, holy.
Yeah, is it Kodash or the other one?
They're spelled the same, just different pronunciation of vowels. Yeah. Same word. It means holy or set aside.
And the one that Sisera thought was a friend, the wife
of Heber or Eber?
Right. Term code or whatever you want to say, changed.
Yeah. We'll discuss that, hopefully. Hopefully we'll get that today.
I think it's interesting when Deborah says that you won't receive the glory, but it will be given to a woman. Initially, you think it's Deborah that's going to get,
exactly.
credit, and it's actually
Yael. In another way, it also is Deborah.
Right.
Because think about it, when you think of Deborah as a judge, do you think of Barak?
No.
I don't. I forget that he was even there. And I'm like, oh, that's right. There was a guy named Barak. Deborah's the one, remember, right? She still gets the glory.
Right.
You're absolutely right in both ways.
Right.
Jael gets the actual kill of the bad guy. And Deborah's the one, remember. Few people remember Barak until they reread the story. Oh, yeah, there is a guy that does this.
True. Hopefully the same will be on election day.
We won't discuss that.
And the woman is the judge, not her husband, Lapidoth, whatever he did.
Right.
And
we'll discuss that.
The people are doing what was right in their own eyes until Deborah, and I think later on it calls her a mother
yes.
in Israel.
The next chapter is she's a mother of Israel. Yes, Hank.
11. What is the significance of now Eber the Canaanite, the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, separated himself from the Canaanite? It goes into a whole little
a subcategory of some story going
there,
on.
That typically, it'll list tribes and stuff, and it doesn't give the explanation of who
history.
They are, a brief history.
Right.
And I was wondering if there's a tie to that, or
there is a specific reason as to why it is there in chapter 4, because he's out of place.
Okay.
The Kenites all dwelt with essentially Simeon down the southern tip of Israel. That's where they dwelt. That's where they lived.
Right.
They were nomadic people. So what is a Kenite doing all the way up here at the north tip of Israel?
Vacation.
He's separated himself. The point is they're trying to explain to you. There's other reasons too, which we'll get into hopefully today. As to why Heber is even close to in this territory. This should be so far away that he couldn't care less. Because they should be all down and south, where all the rest of his family is. Well, the point is they're telling you, all right, he is up here, and this is why he is up here. Thus, this whole opportunity with Yael was able to kill Sisera. The reason he's up there is because he had separated himself. It's a background story to catch you up as to what you didn't know before. We'll discuss a little bit as to his personal family's, meaning his section of the Kenites, not all Kenites, but his little group, why they had a treaty with the king, Jabin, king of Hazor, even though they were Israelites. So we'll discuss that hopefully briefly today. Well, you all have great comments and a few good questions. I think we'll be able to get to all of them without any trouble. I shouldn't be able to go too fast because this is not that long of a chapter. So, I have some questions and hopefully some of you can answer them. Well, actually, I take that most of the answers, but I'm kind of rhetorical. Okay, verse 2, Jabin, king of Canaan in Hazor. Jabin, how you pronounce it, king of Canaan. That's the same person, or correction, same name that Joshua killed. He killed one of them. When he took Hazor, he was killed. Jabin, king of Hazor. Common name. Call what it means. I wrote it down previously. Well, it doesn't matter what it means. It was commonly, it actually was a successive name. So we use Abimelech. There are a lot of Abimelechs in the Bible. You run across them over and over and over again.
Henry the Eighth.
Exactly, Henry the Eighth. First thing, whatever, all the way through. Yabin is no different. He just took the name. He happened to live, by the way, my little map. This is a zoomed in section of the top half of Israel's territory according to the tribes. So you know those tribes not shown up here. You got a little section here at Dan, but it's off my map. Judah's further south, and Reuben is off to the bottom corner. Because this story does not concern them. Why not?
Because it doesn't say it.
Well, that's true. It doesn't say it. It does concern them indirectly in the following chapter, but it doesn't concern them right now. Why not?
Did they have a king down south?
Well, yeah. There were other kings and issues and other countries down south that they had to deal with.
No, but the judges were up north? Or?
No. Judges were scattered throughout all of Israel. Okay. Some of them south, some of them north, all over the place. That is not an issue. Well, what did we discuss 2 weeks ago? Did Asher come down and attack Moab? No. Did Zebulun come down and attack Moab with Ehud? He was the one who was doing it. No. Did Naphtali come down and attack Moab with Ehud? No. Why not? They're busy with their own kings they gotta fight up north. It didn't take a whole nation to attack a small country or a small king. It took those people who God designated that territory. It's their job to do it. He gave Naphtali, Asher, all these various districts or areas to the tribes. And what did he tell them? When you go in this land, dispossess the people that are there. It's going to take you a long time to do it. It's going to consume time, years, generations. So they're up here busy with their own issues, and Hazor is one of them. While the south is busy down there with their issues, which the Philistines now, of course, are on the scene. So Judah is continuously now fighting back and forth with Philistines ever since Shamgar, the end of Ehud's time. That doesn't end. They fight all the way through the kings. They're still fighting. Even when Israel's captured completely and taken off, the Philistines still exist. They never get wiped out. So they're busy. They can't just drop everything and come north and to work. There's a reason why chapter 5 does not... We haven't read that yet. But chapter 5 criticizes some of the tribes for not coming to this particular battle we just read. Some of the tribes are not mentioned at all. Judah is one of them. It's not mentioned at all. Why not? They're busy. They're being killed and killing back and forth. They have their own battle to fight with the Philistines who have invaded their territory. That's fine for them not to come and fight because they're preoccupied. I believe it's Gad, I think is one of the ones, that is mentioned but not criticized. Why? Because he's on the other side of Jordan. He can't cross that easily because why? Well, what's further over here? Well, the rest of Moab and Ammon, who don't like Israel, they're busy fighting too. So they're not criticized for not coming to this particular battle. This happens to be the final decisive battle of Canaan, meaning the Canaanite people are no longer a threat after Hazor, the king of Hazor, dies. The rest of their issues come from Ammon, come from Moab, come from outside the country or the Philistines. The Canaanites themselves are still around, but they're not significant. They're not big players anymore. This is the last stronghold of the Canaanite territory. So, Hazor, it says, Jabin's king of all Canaan. What's left of Canaan, by the way, at this point? Yeah, there's about 3 or 4 cities up here. It doesn't take a lot to be a king of 3 or 4 towns. Because prior to when Joshua took Jabin, the king of Hazor, 200 years earlier, 150 years earlier, he was just the king of Hazor, not king of all of Canaan. Because all of Canaan was still huge and he didn't have control over it. This new guy who came on the scene, he had control of his little territory up there. He was still powerful, still strong, but that was the main thrust of what was left of Canaan. Now, my little map. I have Kadesh and the little red cities because they're easier to see. This Hazor is the top end of Naphtali's and Naphtali's territory. Kadesh is just short for the south. Now, Kadesh is a Levite city. It's a city of refuge. All right, so it's a well-fortified town because they don't allow just anybody to come in. So it's really a relatively large town this time as well. Kadesh was not owned by the king of Hazor. Influenced, yes, but not actually owned. He didn't conquer the town. He didn't have to. That is why Barak could travel from Kadesh all the way down to Bethel to talk to Deborah and come all the way back to Kadesh. No problems. Because though Hazor had control, he didn't have ownership. There was no massive slaughtering of Israelites to gain this ownership. He did kill, obviously, but he didn't slaughter all this whole territory. This is where it becomes important. My little map here. I mean, this little blob here is the Sea of Galilee. The Dead Sea is further down south. I have this little map here. There's Mount Carmel. This is just topography, so you're familiar with what's going on, where the map is. Mount Carmel is here. This is Jezreel Valley. I've dotted it in little red lines. It's bordered by, there's some hills, mountain range down to the south, which I didn't name. I have a little green light Nazareth, just so you're familiar with kind of where everything is. There's Nazareth, mountain range up top, and Mount Tabor, which is in red. This is where the battle takes place, Mount Tabor. And it shows you this little squiggly line is the Kishon Brook, or the Kishon River. It's about a 25-mile-long, roughly, creek that's pretty much dry all year round. Only gets rain during the wintertime or some when it rains, and it's not usually that severe. It's a minuscule rain. Except on occasion, when it does rain severely, it becomes a very large river. Large relative to the area. About 65 feet or so across. Runs about, runs about 15 to 20 miles an hour as far as it's a pretty fast river when it's raining. Why? Jezreel Valley, though, is not very tall. It's so like maybe a couple hundred feet above sea level. It's surrounded by all these mountains, and guess where they drain? Right down into the valley. And then it flushes out to just north of Mount Carmel, the Kishon Brook.
It's a very big valley.
Megiddo is on the eastern tip of the valley. Jezreel Valley comes as like two main battles that occur, or sorry, one main battle and one other event, which we are very familiar with. It is a prophet who happens to destroy all the Baal gods. You recall the prophet? Yeah, Elijah. This is where he gets most of his people from, as far as most of the residents or inhabitants are in this area. This area is ideal for chariots. It's very flat. Like I said, it's about 120 or so feet above sea level. It's flat the whole way except down here toward the bottom end. It actually starts dropping below sea level, but it's not flooded. It's just below sea level. I forgot its name. And it just drains over to the Mediterranean Sea. Very flat territory, surrounded by mountains on all sides. Ideal for a big battle. This is why he's Armageddon. Why? Because it's such a huge, empty, vast, open space. Perfect for battles. Let's see. Anything else I need to tell you? Background? No. All right. There are some differences in Deborah's story than we did in Ehud's story or Othniel's story. What did the people not do this time after 20 years? You know, Othniel, after 8 years, what did the people do? Do you recall this is 2 weeks ago? I know it's a little farther away. What did the people do with being oppressed under... They cried out. And it took them 8 years, but they didn't. And then when they were oppressed in Ehud's time by Moab, what did they do? They cried out. What did they not do here?
They didn't cry out.
20 years go by and they don't cry out. It's a long time and they still didn't cry. Chapter 5 explains what was going through their minds at the time. Crying out wasn't an issue. Abandoning was the issue. Chapter 5, Dan is in the process of evacuating. Asher is saying, it's not my fight. I'm not even coming near you people. Reuben said, you know what? I'm busy. I don't want to deal with this. You guys have your own problems up north, and we're happy where we're at. They didn't need to cry out because they weren't all being oppressed. Or they were not being oppressed to the same extent. Oh, the whole, all of Israel was not being oppressed by these people.
We are talking about in the time of Deborah.
Yes, yes.
Because verse 3 says, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord.
Mine doesn't say that. Mine doesn't say that at all.
What
translation do you have?
That's funny. I'll have to look at that again. This is Reuben edition. Mine does not have that verse in it whatsoever.
And no commentary.
No commentary on it.
This is
the Torah.
Oh,
that's just the Torah.
Oh,
that's right.
Isn't that the stone edition? That's like
it's a brand of it, yes.
Yeah. It's unusual.
That's fascinating. Well, then I don't know about that. I'll leave that open because I don't know why my section would have a missing verse. Sometimes it does. Not mistakenly missing, but there's probably a reason why it's missing, and I'll have to hold off. So I'll stop that point, whether or not they cried out or not, until I can prove or get more evidence supporting it. I was not aware that the English Bible had a verse that mine did not. It happens, but it's rare. Okay. Move on past that. What's unique, verse 4, of Deborah versus all the other judges?
She's a woman.
She's a woman, that's one of them.
And she's a wife.
Yeah, she's a wife. We'll talk about that. We don't know about that just yet. I'll tell you what the word actually says in a moment. So, actually, there's a couple of things. One, yes, she's female. Another one, she's a prophet or prophetess. That's not usually described with the judges. They're actually called prophets or prophetesses. There are exceptions. She's one of the first ones that ever done so. I'll write it up here. I don't know how to spell prophet. How do you spell prophet?
P-R-O-P-H-B-T-E-S-S.
She's that's the E there. Terrible speller. Okay. She's prophetess. She... I lost my little notes here. She's a wife. Now, are we sure?
This version says she's the wife of
Lebedoth.
So
how do you pronounce it?
What does that mean? Is there another translation?
Actually, what actually states in Hebrew, she is a Lebed or Lebedo woman. Does not say Lebedo's wife, different Hebrew word. She's a Lebedo or Lebed woman.
In Hebrew, wives are not, in context, are not possessive to the husband.
Normally that's true. And we don't know if she is or is not. Because why? What does Lebedo mean?
What does it mean?
It means a torch. Or fire. Lebedoth, Lebedot, Lebedo, they're all the same basic words.
Fire or torch?
Fire or torch is what it actually means.
What is the Hebrew for the word wife?
Oh, I looked it up early this morning and I forgot it. There's a biblical Hebrew. There's a biblical Hebrew which is slightly different.
Isha. But
it could be Alma.
It could be.
That's why I was wondering what
the word was. I looked up this morning. I recall. I did a little three-sentence paragraph about it.
So what was the name of the main fire?
It says Labadoth means fire or torch.
Oh, that was the wife?
In English, they translate that stating. Right. She is Labadoth's wife.
So you'd have to know the Hebrew.
You have to know what it actually means, because the word wife is not in Hebrew. It's woman. Hmm. What is that supposed to mean? Labadoth, same word, means fire or torch. So there are three possibilities of what this is actually saying. Four possibilities of what this is actually saying. One is the English translation, Labadoth's wife. That could be exactly what it means. There are three competing Jewish philosophies of what this is actually saying. One, she's a fiery woman, meaning she's actually a heavy-spirited woman, one who is aggressive.
Irish.
Yes, Jeff.
Well, doesn't Barak mean thunderbolt?
Yes, it does.
Thunderbolt.
Yes.
I mean, she was a real hot item.
Oh, we'll go there now. So it actually, his comment about Barak is one of those competing four theories. Labadoth means fire or torch.
So Barak means.
Say it again. Barak means lightning or thunderbolt.
So
one theory is that she's a fiery person. Her personality is what's discussing. One who is willing to go out to battle. I mean, how many women at the biblical time were willing to go out to fight in battle?
Joan of Arc.
Yeah, yours probably one of them. She just killed a guy. That's one. There's a few, but honestly they're very common. That may be what it means. It can also mean she's a wick maker.
Oh.
Because wicks at this time were made frequently by women. And what were the wicks used for? We're not talking little candle wicks. We're talking one particular instrument. It's called a menorah. Wick making. That is a correct, equally correct, say, translation of what it means. Those things. That's one, two, that's three theories. The fourth one, which is to me a little stretchy, Raubag believes this, and I won't say he's right or wrong. Torch and lightning are technically allowed to be used interchangeably. In his theory, she is the wife of Barak.
The
thunder and lightning. That's his theory. I don't see it's right or wrong, but these are all four competing theories. The problem is that he was not clear enough to specify she's actually the wife of an individual. It just says she's a fiery woman is what it means, what it says, or a torch woman. It could mean that she is the woman of Labadoth, meaning wife. It could mean that she's a woman of fire or torch, which it could also be translated as or interchangeable with Barak's name, Barak's wife. It could also mean that she's a fiery human being, her personality, her character. Or it could mean she makes wicks for a living. All of them are completely equal. All right, so we don't know if she actually is or is not married. It doesn't really matter the story. But I found it interesting to note that, wow, this is kind of interesting little lady. We don't know a whole lot about her. And besides, Labadoth, as far as I know, has no family history. I mean, they don't know who he came from or who was supposed to be his father. No chronology for his life. Not to say that's a key that says it's wrong. It just means that just didn't happen to write it down. Yes.
Barak had no... He's
a son of... Barak. I'm talking about Labadoth. The word Labadoth.
Okay, I got you.
If Labadoth was a person, the Bible did not happen to record his genealogy. So no one knows where he came from, what tribe he's associated with, no knowledge of him whatsoever. Most men, not all, but most have son of so-and-so. Well, Labadoth didn't have one. So we don't know if it's actually a person or whether it's just a description. That's my point. She dwelt under a date palm tree, verse 5. I could go into that, but I'm not going to. It's not that important to the story. It happens to be on Mount Ephraim or near Mount Ephraim. Do you recall what important happenings occurred on Mount Ephraim? It's approximately a little shortly north of Bethel, about this area. Who lived there? Anybody recall? Correction, who's buried there?
Where?
Mount Ephraim, this little red dot I put up here. Not that the map helps, but Joshua's buried there. That's his mountain. That's his territory. Is she relative? I have no idea. But she happens to live or work in that same spot. Maybe she's related. She's probably from the tribe of Ephraim since she lived in the territory? Most likely. Is she a descendant of Joshua? I have no clue. But if she happens to live or work where he lived and was buried and his family lived. Could be. Who knows? He owned the whole mountain, so it's possible that she actually was a descendant of his. So I thought that was kind of cool. We're going to stop at verse 8, but we're going to get there first. Barak had to convince the people in verse 6. Who was he told to go out and to convince? Who was Barak told to go out and convince?
Sons of Naphtali and sons of Zebulun.
Exactly. So two tribes, his job was to go out and to convince.
10,000
men combined. How many came from who doesn't matter. That was his task. Now, did it say that God would help him with this task?
No.
No. This is Barak's job. Go out, rally the troops. That's your task. What did God say would be his task? What God would be doing? He would deliver Sisera into Barak's hand. That's God's job. Barak's job, get the people ready, willing to go to battle. This is one of the reasons why a couple of tribes are ridiculed, more than a couple, in chapter 5, for not willing to come and help. He was able to muster these two tribes, and actually after maybe able to muster a third one, which just happens to not be recorded in chapter 4. It's recorded in chapter 5. He's able to muster parts of Issachar as well to come to battle, since it involves them. What I want to ask, and more importantly, is though he was able to muster up at least these two, and it appears chapter 5, the third tribe of Issachar, who did Hazor, the king of Hazor, have dominion over? Who was his territory of influence? Which tribes were most influenced by this general, this king? Asher's one of them. Who wrote this? Yeah. Asher's one of the tribes. Who else?
Naphtali's
one, since it happens to be in his little territory. Mm-hmm. Who else? Zebulun. And since Issachar joined, most likely Issachar, since the battle took place in Issachar's territory. Who else did he have control over? Well, he traveled all the way to Megiddo, in Manasseh's territory. He also happened to have control over the other half of Manasseh. He had a lot of influence, not ownership, as mentioned. Influence. People had to pay him or pay tribute to him. From all these tribes and two sections from Manasseh, of these, who actually went to battle? Three. He had influence over at least five. Granted, some point out he probably had influence all the way to Dan because he went to the sea, but it's debatable whether he went to the sea in Asher's territory or Dan's territory. No one really knows. So he could have had a sixth tribe. We don't know. These three tribes went to battle. These tribes did not. Asher did not, and the split part of Manasseh did not. They're criticized for not doing so. We'll discuss that next time, as far as what their excuses for not going to battle were. So, Barak goes from Kadesh all the way down to just a hair north of Bethel, where Deborah is, gets the message, comes all the way back up to Kadesh to muster up the troops, his hometown. He gets Naphtali and Zebulun, and of course we wind up parts of Issachar. He musters them at Mount Tabor. Mount Tabor is a single little lone mountain. It's about 4 miles away from the next biggest bump in the road. It's ideal for storing all your troops there. It's covered in trees, at least it was. And what's right below it? Nice open Jezreel Valley. It's a perfect ambush site. It's hard to conquer. It's hard to fight uphill, and chariots have no control fighting uphill. They can't really do it on mountain ranges. That's a foot soldier's job. What did Sisera, by the way, I do not know where the town that he dwelt in is located. All I gathered, by the way, I just want to tell you this, all I gathered was that it is a fortress that was built for protecting or for storing military personnel. That's all we know. All I know. I'm assuming it's somewhere near Jabin or where his territory was, up in this upper region of Naphtali or possibly further north. So he gets word from whomever that Barak and all his people are sitting down here in Mount Tabor. So what does he do? Muster people up. Where does he go? Jezreel Valley. That's the battlefield. He gets all his ISIL chariots in a line, gets all of the infantrymen in a line. And what is he expecting to see? A battle. What does he actually get?
Routed.
And it's interesting to note, chapter 5 gives more details. We have not read that yet, so I don't expect you to answer this. But what was God's method of routing?
Water.
What did I tell you before about the unique properties of the Kishon Brook? It's dry all the time, except when it rains heavy. Then it's a really big rushing river. What's the worst thing to be if you're a chariot heavy down with armor? What's the worst place to be at? Mud and water. Worst place. Chapter 5 says that the Lord came, brought rain down, and flushed them down the Kishon Brook. Not 100% of the people didn't have to. But the point is, it points out in chapter 4 that God confused them before Barak. What would be a greater confusing than a torrential downpour that wipes out half your soldiers? And most importantly, makes your chariots unable to ride, which is why Sisera got off his chariot and ran on foot.
Well, and it says in the beginning, the chariots, the 900 chariots, were their reason for crying. Chariots of iron were their reason for crying out. This was his, this was his sword that
exactly.
kept them in submission with.
Exactly. And what better tool would God use? Wipe out the chariots, leaving nothing but infantry and a few other people around to battle. Yes, Susan.
This is mirroring the Red Sea.
This is very similar to Red Sea.
Yeah.
It's very similar. And for a case, I think, for important reasons. Mm-hmm. That it is a miracle battle, and the people realize, Barak's people realize, Zebulun mm-hmm. and Naphtali, the people, the soldiers. Chapter 5, it may be poetic, it might be factual, we don't know, points out that amongst 40,000 Israelites, there was no sword nor shield to be found amongst them before this battle. You have 10,000 men, and amongst 40,000 people, there are no shield, no swords, no tools for fighting. How do you plan on fighting a battle? Most people with swords and shields. What if your people don't have any? You take them off the people you knock over. In this case, you take them off the people that God wipes out ahead of you.
Yeah.
Armed them all. I'm not saying it's correct. It could be just poetic form of a song. It happens. It's the next chapter is a song. But if it is correct, and Jewish philosophy is very adamant that it is dead on perfect, then the theory that God swept them out with water, leaving, of course, metal sinks. It doesn't float. It goes straight down. And it says the people, the Israelites, were able to walk right across the brook with no problem. But Sisera's army was wiped out during the process. It implies, the Jewish philosophy, that he left all the armor there to grab, and the swords to grab, and go kill off the remnant. Easy to do at that point. I know I'm dipping into chapter 5 a lot because it's a lot of the answers are there, so it's hard to just focus on one chapter at a time. Verse 8, I gotta stop. I gotta go a little faster actually, but let's stop verse 8. Barak's response before, I know I did all this battle scene pretty much right ahead of time, but I wanted to stop here and I didn't. Barak's response to Deborah, what was it?
And you want her to go with him.
Well, then you go with him.
Why?
Because you knew she was a prophetess, that she was a judge. And God
they believe her.
With her.
What was her response?
I'll go, but...
But?
You not getting the glory, a woman is.
Right. So was Barak right in saying, no, I won't go until you come with me, Deborah? Should he have done that?
Sure. Well, I mean, he would have gotten glory if he had more faith to stand on his own with God and do it. But because he was, you know, wanting assurance from her or have, you know, wanted her, you know, support, he lost the credit.
Yes, he did lose the credit. Yes,
Susan. She says to him, Yahweh is giving you this order.
Yes.
He should have obeyed what Yahweh said.
He should have obeyed it.
There'd been a demonstration over the last, I don't know how many hundred years, to do what Yahweh says to do, otherwise you don't win the battle.
Exactly. Well, you don't. Yeah. That is as absolutely correct. You both have a great point.
Yeah.
Susan's right. Verbatim, he was given a command. He did not do the command verbatim.
12 spies.
Same scenario. All right, they did not follow the way they were supposed to follow. Not to say that God didn't make provision on Barak's case if he did not follow, but as he quite clearly did. He allowed Yair to be there, Heber to have moved probably years earlier up to this location. He set the scenario in motion. Most likely, in my opinion, he already knew Barak was going to say no. That's my opinion. God already knew ahead of time. Barak's going to say no. He's going to be fearful. And he's going to say, no, Deborah, you come with me. Now, it was to his benefit that Deborah did go. Because what did she do when she was there, which we haven't read yet? She musters up the third tribe, Issachar. He doesn't. She does. So it was good that she did go. But not necessarily the way God had originally wanted it to happen. Yeah, not how he had commanded it to happen. Not that he wouldn't allow another scenario to occur. If you recall, 2 weeks ago, what did we say about the Philistines, about their arrival? What was the reason they showed up? Because...
Yeah, they didn't wipe out the other people who were there.
Exactly. Israel was not forceful enough or willing to go do the job God gave them. So what did he do? He raised up somebody else who would do it instead. If you're not willing, that's not a death sentence to you. God's will is going to be accomplished whether you're willing to do it or not. It makes no difference. Sisera and all of his army was going to be wiped out. Whether or not Barak had the strength to do it or not didn't matter. So whether he was right or wrong in what he did, that's always going to be academic. It doesn't really matter. If the result still occurred.
He was not condemned, though.
He wasn't condemned.
You know, in other situations, you know, like with the 12 spies.
Well, Christian, he was partially condemned. Deborah did correct him. Hey, as a result, because you're not willing to do this.
There was a consequence. There
was consequence for it.
The truth of the matter is, though, Yahweh doesn't share his glory with another. So Barak would not be getting a whole lot, shouldn't be wanting a whole lot of glory anyway.
That's true. It's a humble way of putting it. And it's right. She's right. He shouldn't be wanting it. And apparently, he didn't.
Yeah.
It was worth it. Well, he didn't want it.
Well, my freedom.
Glory or death.
So, was it lack of faith on Barak's part?
Perhaps.
Could have been lack of faith. Requiring or needing Deborah, who, by the way, all of Israel trusted at this point. She was the judge at this time. Could be lack of faith on his part. We don't know. It could be that he believed the troops would rally behind Deborah more than him, which it appears was the case for at least Issachar, that they rallied around her, not him. Maybe there were other reasons he had. We don't know. The Bible was not specific enough to say what reasons he had. But whatever they are, God's will was still done in spite of them, which can happen in each of us in our own personal lives. I want to remember that. These are people. People are people. That's just what they do. Their lives are neither good nor bad. They're just lives. They make good decisions. They make bad decisions. God's will is always accomplished, is my point. In your own life, my life, God's will always be accomplished whether or not I'm willing to do it or not. The Philistines, God's will is always accomplished whether or not I'm willing to do it or not, Barak, is that case? Your hand up.
Would you agree that it's a similar mentality we see through the Israelite people through the olive judges? As long as the judge is there, it's like they have their physical representation of God's promise with them. You know, and they want to be close to that, and, you know, because that's where God channels his blessing through the judge in their time.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as they're taken away, it seems that strife hits again, mm-hmm. and they fall back. And so we see here with Barak that, you know, he goes, okay, I see the plan, but help me out, you know, because you're the judge. I trust God is with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, will you do this with me? You know, I'm not doing this if you don't do this with me, kind of a thing, you know.
Right. I think I do follow you. And yes, that is fairly consistent with all of Israel. They do require a judge to rally behind, require someone who is stronger than they, that they believe God's behind in order to accomplish a task. That is pretty consistent. And Barak may be just an obvious reflection of that mentality of all of Israel.
Yeah, and just picking up what Hank said, it gives a little window into the role and the acceptance of women even in that time.
Yeah.
That all of Israel, and a palm, it was Deborah's palm tree she sat under.
Mm-hmm.
This is sort of imagery that would normally be associated with a man,
mm-hmm.
but she's definitely a woman, whether she is married or not. And that Barak knew that she was the figurehead. It's like having Queen Elizabeth I or II. The whole
yes.
country recognized her authority.
Exactly. That is absolutely correct.
It's a nice little vignette, isn't it?
Yes.
You tend to pin the ancients down into...
Right, and it's not fair. It's the same thing we did with people did with Ehud when he was left-handed. He withered right hand, a non-functioning right hand, and the custom was not to be left-handed. Whether you were left or not, it didn't make a difference. You forced to be right-handed, forced them into a livelihood. The fact we talked about poop 2 weeks ago, the Bible, it's not apologetic. It was discussing about, hey, you know what, this way life is. This is what happened. Take it or leave it, it's your business. It's real. It's just that's the way life is. The story of Deborah is no different. That's what life is. It's just how it happened. We accept it. And it does continuously tear down a little bit stereotypes we always see put upon stories that we think the way people once acted.
Yeah.
But people are the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
Right.
We don't change. The same cruddy and dirtiness we have today. Well, the same cruddy and dirtiness we had 6,000 years ago.
Yeah.
We're still cruddy and dirty. Nothing changes. Yes, Jeff.
Then we just have more expensive toys.
Well, that's true. We do more expensive toys. Cost changes. Don't give me that one. Price tag changes. Inflation's always there. But people's character do not. So Barak is probably no different than all of Israel at that time as well as today. They needed someone to rally behind. He knew it. And he planned accordingly. Judaism criticizes him heavily for this, that he was gutless. He could not do this alone because he was too afraid. He didn't believe. The commentators criticize him for Rashi, Ralbag, you name them. All the big name, big guys say, hey, he failed miserably at this. Some Christianity groups do the same. Saying that, hey, because Israel was so desperate and so pathetic, they didn't have a good male to turn to, they had to turn to a woman. Because there's nothing left. Right or wrong, I don't care what the commentaries have to say beyond that. It's just that perspectives, we force our own perspectives upon what we're viewing. Not necessarily what happened.
Yes, but it's interesting that Judaism is a post-first century philosophical system of thought.
Correct.
And likewise, Christian too. But what we have to remember is this, that during the early 2nd and 1st century BCE, there was a huge Hellenization program that took place that affected all of the system of thought that led from the 1st century after the Messiah was born.
Correct.
It was heavily influenced by Aristotle and philosophy,
mm-hmm.
and fed very strongly with his pupil Plato, which basically had a bias against women.
Very much so.
And that is very, very strong, and it can be demonstrated through Aristotle's and Plato's writings, where a woman was reduced to the
property.
Level of a possession.
Right.
Right.
Straight property.
And actually had no rights or anything of her own. That is not biblical.
Right. You're absolutely
that
correct.
That is what fed Judaism, the rabbis, Rabbag, all of the ones.
All of them come the same way.
The early church fathers. And
you're
that,
absolutely right.
That has influenced how we've even translated the scriptures over the last 2,000 years.
I completely agree with you on that point. It's completely correct. They are heavily influenced by Greek philosophy at that time, or at the time which they're commenting, which is one of the reasons they are probably very critical. They're not only critical of Deborah, by the way. They criticize Rachel. They criticize Leah. They criticize Sarah. They criticize every female you can think of being, well, yes, they did things right, but they were a woman, and they were supposed to do whatever they had to kind of flip their heads, dictate that what her life should have been like, and it wasn't. Thus, she had to step up and do something else. God helped her.
Remember in the Talmud, they even blamed the woman for the lack of crops.
They blamed the woman for everything.
Well, it goes back to what you were teaching about.
It's very consistent.
Eve
being blamed.
The blaming of Eve, you know, and really how false that is. You know, Adam named her the mother of life, not the mother of death, you know.
Orthodox prayers still say that.
Still say it.
Wasn't born a woman.
Yes, they still say that. Yep.
That's the last thing you see. Boy, it's a bunch of born a queen. Then they say that. It's a little way down the bottom of the list.
We're at the bottom. You know what the law says, though? He who is last born.
So that'd be first. All the gold, all the fish.
We're gonna clean this up. I'm gonna spend the next 4 minutes and finish off this chapter. We're gonna leave Barak and his battlefield, move on to Sisera and why he went to Yair's tent. Kenites, who were they? Do you remember? I know it's been a while, like a month and a half.
Associated with the people of Israel.
Of Israel.
From the time of Jethro and
exactly.
Moses.
What type of people were they?
Nomadic
is one of their characteristics. What's the other kind of person that where they were?
Gypsy.
Sheep.
They were
sheep. Nomads, yes, they're
yeah.
Sheep herders.
Okay. Yeah.
What was that?
They were smiths also.
In a manner of speaking, that's one of their functions. They're
the
also very religious individuals.
Oh, yes.
Because of Jethro, he was a priest of Midian.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he was a priest of Midian. Why? Because, well, first of all, number one, he was Midianite by race. And the Kenites, though they married into, or Moses married into them and had children, they still remained and maintained their own identity all the way through this time. Why is it so easy for them to travel? They look like everybody else. They're Midianites. They're nomads. Nobody argues whether or not they're in the south, north. They moved all over the place. What is Eber doing? Why did he move first all the way north with his wife and family? They're nomads. They moved. The Midian is easy to strike a deal with if you happen to be a king of Canaan because he thinks you're Midianite. Where's Midian at this point in their lives? Midian's just as pagan as the rest of them. There's no righteousness in Midian. Well, there probably is some, but not a whole lot. There's righteousness in almost everywhere, but, so, as far as striking a deal in Hazor's mind, the king of Hazor's mind, Jabin, in his opinion, doesn't make any difference. He's a Midianite. He's not part of these Israelite scum that I have to deal with. He's part of, kind of like one of us. Very easy to strike a deal with. Doesn't matter to Jabin, king of Hazor, who he strikes a deal with, as long as they're not Israelites. So yeah, they had a cordial relationship. They had peace between the two of them. There was no issue there. That's why Sisera was comfortable going to them for aid, for a shelter.
Or did he pick the wrong
place? Yeah, he picked the wrong
woman.
Wrong woman. He probably better off go to Eber's tent and then it would be a different result. Why did he go to a woman's tent? Well, why not Eber's tent? Exactly. No one's you're dealing with Israelites who are chasing him. He knows a rough lifestyle that they live, or that they're supposed to live. Not exactly believes it, but he knows a general idea. And it was custom in that territory. You do not enter a woman's tent without her explicit permission. It's off limits. I don't care if you're fighting battle, makes no difference. You all wait and you stay outside.
Yeah.
It's respectful. He's all respectful. In fact, it's another man's wife, which is even worse. So yeah, Zisra would go to her tent. He knew he was safe. Eber's tent, not so safe. They'd come down, open tent, go in there, find him, kill him, whatever they need to do. Well, her tent, not so. He knew he was safe in there. She, or her, Eber, I should say, was at peace, I'll use that term loosely, with Yabin, the king of Hazor. So, was she supposed to be at peace with them, too? Yes. It's part of the family, part of the same clan. They made their deal. By the way, where they happen to be camping at, no one knows. But they're probably somewhere in the same general vicinity of the battlefield, give or take some. Probably further north. So yeah, she was supposed to be at peace with him. So why would she kill him?
Well, she must have a religious background, and she knew that he was going against God's people, and she didn't want to go against God's people.
He must be ill.
If that was the case, well, wouldn't Eber have thought the same philosophy? They, though descendants, and though they were technically Midianite by race, all of Jethro's clan adapted and walked and became Israelites by religion. They still maintain their lifestyle as far as nomadic lifestyle. Still very religious individual, people who are orientated about God. But why would Hazor and Eber strike a deal if Eber knew ahead of time, this is no good, we can't do that, we're Israelites. And Yael, my name's mixed up here. Too many names. Yael was able to, or was willing to, kill Sisera, and did so. Was she right?
I believe so.
Yeah.
Yeah, we all say yeah. She, what she did was right. Yeah, because he was a bad guy.
Well, he was in opposition to Israel.
Yes, he was. So why were they at peace to begin with?
Trading purposes?
I mean,
you probably knew
that
the battle was lost.
Do you recall, you can see it, my little red dots,
yeah.
Israel Valley. What else is important about this particular valley? Everybody can see everything. And I'm using black so you can see. Guess where all the major trading routes were? All the way through the valley. And continue on further south. Well, there's a couple of them went that way too, little small ones. What does a nomad do?
Trade.
They trade. What were they doing making deals with Hazor?
Making money.
Trade routes. The deal wasn't, because we are opposing religions, I will not attack you, you will not attack me. No. The deal is, we have stuff to sell. Anybody willing to buy? The same thing that Abraham would do, the same thing that Isaac did and Jacob did and every one of the patriarchs. I don't have to agree with you philosophically or religiously.
Right.
I have a product I'm willing to sell. I won't fight you. You don't fight me. Do you want to buy my product? And can I buy what you have?
Mm-hmm. Still the same today.
It's the same.
Trade shows, it's full of Jews.
Exactly. So whatever it is. There's a joke. There's a trade show my boss used to be going to. He said, if there are certain trade shows you can, it was a joke, that you shut the lights off and shuffle everybody around to turn it back on again, then we dead silence for about a minute. And then they'll all be selling what they're currently, what's behind them now. It doesn't matter what they're selling. It's like, oh, look at your product. Oh, okay, I'm selling this. You want to buy it? It's business. It's true. The salesman doesn't matter what they're selling. They'll just sell whatever it is. Exactly. It makes that much worse. So yeah, the peace between them wasn't a military peace. It was a brokerage deal of trade. It's business. She didn't like Sisera. Eber didn't like Sisera. She didn't have any issues killing him. He's a general. He was a murderer as far as she's concerned because he went to battle. She can kill him. That's not the issue. So it doesn't matter. She was equally at war with Hazor, religiously speaking and territorial, but not business speaking. That's who the Kenites were. They're nomadic people. They don't care who they do business with. They'll still fight you and sell stuff to you at the same time. Not right or wrong. That's just who nomads are. That's what they do. And it's perfectly fine. So,
you know, we read this, it's very antiseptic, but can you imagine taking a tent?
Oh, yes.
And he's asleep and having...
And having to pound it.
Just right in there.
That is huge.
The strength.
And the strength to do it. Yes, Tammy.
That's not an easy hit.
No.
Hey, I would dispute that because that was a woman's job.
Yeah.
Putting tents up.
That's the easiest place to kill somebody.
Yes, I'm talking about the act of killing.
Killing a human being.
But Anne was saying, though, about her strength or whatever, but that's what she did. She would take up that tent and she would put it down. So we're not talking about...
Well, she may have had servants, too. Who knows?
But we're not talking about some little woman.
Right.
That doesn't have strength. That she's just some flower.
I'm not talking about...
It's the ability to kill another human being with that method.
But on the other hand, if you think about that culture in that time, I mean, there are a lot of people in this country who have never seen an animal slaughtered.
That's true.
We live a very sanitized life. We never see death.
That's very true.
She
would see it probably every other day.
They saw death.
Anybody takes a human life easily.
Glenn was cheaper. I thought Glenn was cheaper back then.
Maybe. Less consequences. Less jail time.
When you're at war, you don't consider to take a human life. You actually are going to stop the enemy from coming any farther.
You think about it later.
It's a different priority.
Different priority.
You think about it later.
1% time. Yes, Anne, what did you have to say?
Do you think that maybe, I thought she felt taken advantage of in a way, and he didn't offer her anything. You know, she came in there. I mean, he came in there, give me water, and then don't do this and this. And if a man comes to the door saying...
She's very wily. She says, come in.
She said to come in.
She invited him.
She invited him.
Yes.
I think her goal was to kill him.
Yeah.
I think her goal was to kill him.
Yeah.
I gave her warm milk. You know what warm milk does to guys? Knocks it out.
Yeah, my son's a case in study on that one. More milk will knock him out in a heartbeat.
So she was kind of like the woman in Proverbs chapter 7 or whatever.
One thing I wanted to mention, the warm milk, the nomadic people had a particular type of milk they would actually use. It wasn't, you know, we just think of like, you know, okay, goat's milk, whatever, swimming milk. No, it's not quite that. It's more consistent with yogurt rather than it actually is milk. They would put milk, or actually the cream of milk, into a skin or some kind of a skin, and swish it around. Much like we create butter, so very similarly, but there would be obviously other things in it. It's a very thick food. It's very thick buttermilk, essentially, is what it is. It is more rich and easier to knock someone out with as far as when they're eating too much of it. So it's probably what she used as well. The word is not that descriptive as far as what it specifies.
2%.
But, not 2%. Any other questions? I'm going to call it quits. I'm way over time, but I apologize. It was fun. Any questions or comments?
She's pretty proud of herself.
Yes, she is.
Because at the end, she tracks them down, Barack and
Deborah. And says, hey, look. We'll see Vanna White going like, oh, yeah. Thank you.